You're waiting with bated breath to hear this. How does something, quote, something, take you to nothing? And so, that, like, the pattern we're doing is when you're contemplating impermanence of the conditioned realm. So, you know, there's all that we see, hear, smell, taste, touch, think, remember, the body, everything is conditions. It arises and ceases, begins and ends. So it's something. All these are some things or things. And so then no thing is where the absence of something. And what we do, say, in terms of, if say a mood or an emotion, say anger arises. So you're aware that there's anger. That's something, isn't it? Anger is something. And then, if you're mindful of the anger, the feeling, you accept it, you're not trying to get rid of it, or you're not believing it and following it, you're just, that which is aware of it is not angry. Isn't it like mindfulness isn't angry? Maybe the mood or the thing that has arisen in consciousness is an angry thing. But that which is aware of anger isn't angry. And that's the refuge in the Buddha. That's the ability to reflect and be aware, pay attention. And then the thing ceases because it's impermanent. Anger's not ultimate reality. And then there's no anger or no thing. And that which is aware of no thing, of no anger, you see? So it's that's what we mean by the witness or the observer. So you can see the Dhamma. This is what we call Dhamma, or the way things are. What arises ceases, that pattern of impermanence. And to see, and to realize the absence of something when it ceases, is also mindfulness. So, like space and form, and the self and non-self, attachment and non-attachment, desire and desirelessness. But in order to have something take you to nothing, or something take you to nothing, you have to accept the something for what it is. You have to know it. Like desire, in order to realize desirelessness, you have to know what desire is. You have to be an expert on what desire is. And just recognize that desire is like this. And that which is aware of desire isn't desire. Desire is an object. If you're mindful, you can be aware of desire, wanting something. But that which is aware of it isn't wanting anything. This is like contemplating that. Self and no self. Like if that's the emphasis, say, of anatta in Theravada Buddhism. Like the self. What is yourself? The sense of yourself as being somebody. And so I contemplate this, my personality, my memories, all my identities, my appearance, my history, my all the rest that I think is me. And then there's awareness when that's present, when it's absent. And so the absence of a self, of my personality, that which is aware of self and not self, That's just awareness. That's not a person. That's not personality. Is something that comes with thinking, with perception, and with mental formations and so forth. You have to become a person. When you're aware, when there's pure awareness, you're nobody. You're nothing, and nobody. But to become somebody, you have to start thinking, I am somebody. You say, I'm no longer the abbot of Amaravati. Ajahn Veerdhamma is the abbot. And I gave up one of my identities. I wasn't attached to it at all. But these can be attachments, can't we? We can be very attached to our position. I like to contemplate this, like with here in Britain, with all the different schools of Buddhism, and that you kind of, I am a Theravadin or whatever, and you can see that whole, that's, you know, the that comes out of ignorance, out of, that's not Dhamma in that. There's no, that's not Dhamma, that's not Buddha seeing Dhamma, that's me being attached to an idea about being Theravadin. And so then, but you can see those are conditions that arise and cease in the mind. And there's if Buddha taught Dhamma, he didn't teach Buddhism, in fact. Realize that. Buddha didn't teach Buddhism. He taught Dhamma, the way things are. And of course, I'm just saying this. Don't go around saying Ajahn Sumedho says as if I'm ex cathedra. I'm just trying to get you to contemplate. I really don't like being, you know, the idea of having to be kind of a, you know, defender of the faith or something. But what I'm saying is that we're kind of stimulate your own, or encourage an awareness in yourself. Also, I notice in Vipassana practices in Theravada, the emphasis oftentimes is too much on three characteristics. So you get anicca, dukkha, anatta fanatics. And they don't realize cessation, because they're always projecting anicca, dukkha, anatta out of their minds onto everything. That's not what it's meant to be. But it's, you know, you keep hearing, of, like in the States, especially the Vipassana movement, has divorced itself from devotional practices. So it's kind of this, they like a very strict interpretation of a method, of a kind of method of Vipassana, and then the devotional practices are looked down on as, you know, there's Asian people like that stuff, but we don't, the kind of arrogance of we do Vipassana. And even in, I got the latest Tricycle magazine, the kind of Time magazine of Buddhism, and they talk about, in America, they talk about Zen, Mahayana, Tibetan, and Vipassana. And they never mention Theravada. So Vipassana has become kind of a form of Buddhism, divorced from everything else. But I also see that one of the failings of this emphasis on Vipassana is that it is an emphasis on the three sunyata, or the characteristics, anicca, dukkha, anatta. And so the contemplation of the Four Noble Truths is not really done. So people aren't realizing cessation of conditions, or the absence of something. So they, you know, they don't get that insight into cessation, which is the most, you know, that's the liberating insight. Without that, you're not liberated. If you're just thinking everything's anicca dukkha anatta, if you're going to think, use thought, then maybe positive thinking might be your path. Everything is pink and wonderful. After so many years of watching your mind, do you still suffer? That's getting personal, isn't it? Of course I don't suffer. It changes. What happens is your attitude. You become very clear, and that you can see the way things are, which can be pain, and you're willing to feel things and be with the natural suffering and sensitivity of this realm without creating suffering. And that's the insight into cessation, where you actually know the difference between the way things are, which is you can still have a cold, a horrible cold, and feel terrible, you know, physically feel wretched, but you don't create suffering over it in your mind. Or just in the terms of, just the community, say Amravati, living here at Amravati, or things that happen that you don't like or don't want, or disappointments happen in the monastic life, people disrobe or things go wrong or that, and you feel it. You can feel this unpleasantness or this sadness or this, but you're not creating suffering. You see, so it's and it's very clear that this is the way it is, once you see clearly, you don't create suffering anymore. You're no longer inclined to create suffering around what happens to you or the world, which means that we still feel it. For example, the reflection I was given the other morning about Ajahn Chakro in Australia is going to disrobe, and after 24 years, this very fine monk is going to disrobe, and I went to Australia a couple of weeks ago, rushed there to Melbourne on the airplane, and no way could I convince him otherwise. So then, contemplating this feeling, when I think Ajahn Chakro is going to disrobe, then that's a perception, isn't it? I'm thinking that these are words, these are perceptions in my mind. Ajahn Chakro is going to disrobe. And then I notice the feeling from that perception is a sadness. There's a sadness there. But then I don't suffer from that sadness because I accept that feeling, and I'm not making any problem about it. If I just cling to the sadness, then I suffer. If I repress I shouldn't be sad, then that's another form of suffering. But also, one can turn away from the sadness. You know, like, as you understand, the sadness is present and it's absent, then you don't hold on, you don't wallow in it, but you certainly recognize it. So you're actually feeling life, and you're aware of what it is, you know, like grief and things. But you also You can feel this grief, but you're not creating suffering. You see, most people don't know, are not clear enough to know that they identify so strongly with what they're feeling that they have no perspective on it. And then non-attachment or non-grasping, non-attachment is like if I can, like Ajahn Chakra is going to disrobe, then if I stay with that and I keep thinking that over and over, then the sense of sadness is there as long as I keep thinking it. When I stop thinking it and go to the silence in the mind, there's no sadness there. And so you begin to see how to develop the path or the way of non-suffering. And it's very clear, it's not a fuzzy path. But it is subtle. It's hard to see at first because of the strong conditioning and the way we tend to go to extremes. We're so used to extremities that this subtle balance or this middle way is not noticed. Then again, I think I've said before about going to Master Hua's funeral last July, and before they cremated his body, looking at his body, at his face, and then the perception Master Hua is dead. Then thinking Master Hua is dead, and then the visual consciousness of his face, corpse, which was quite, had kind of a beauty to it. His face looked beautiful in his death. I saw him 2 weeks before that when he was still alive. A month or so before that when he was still alive in the intensive care unit. And he looked dreadful when he was alive. And all these tubes going into him. You know, they're kind of trying to keep him alive through pumping all kinds of stuff into him. And then he looked dreadful when I saw him there. Dead, he looked very nice. And so so then Master Hua is dead, and then that is a kind of grief, the sense of loss. And then that loss, that's the grief, ceased. And then there was a kind of peacefulness, a kind of joyful peacefulness. Because with Master Hua, because it wasn't so personal with him, it wasn't a personal attachment in the sense of my personality being attached to his personality, but more of what he represented, the Dhamma, a monk, a good monk who lived and practiced the Dhamma, and then so that I felt when the actual insight was a kind of joyfulness, not joy, happiness that he died, but a joy at the fact that the Dhamma, the teaching, never dies. You know, what's true and real never dies, and that's what, of course, Master Hua was always pointing to in his teaching. Was always pointing to the deathless. I mean, with him, it was a very strong feeling of joy, which, don't get me wrong, I wasn't happy that he died. but then with my mother, it was I didn't have that so much clarity, and that was the grief, and there's a kind of strong personal things would come up. Because that was with your mother, you've got, I mean, that's a unique relationship. But with Ajahn Chah, Master Hua, these monks, because they were very much pointing at truth beyond themselves. And they weren't pointing to themselves and trying to hold you in a personal relationship with them. Where, say, mothers and fathers and friends oftentimes do that. You know, there's a lot of personal investment and desire to hold and cling and attach. Any more questions? Your personality. Well, the thing to know that the personality, it's not like because I mean, like Ajahn Chah, Master Hua, you know, they were very kind of strong characters. They weren't like bland, like just tofu type bhikkhus, no taste. They had very, very kind of, you know, charisma and all this kind of thing. But there was no. They didn't hold to there was no attachment to being anyone or being anything. And so, in our own practice, to ask yourself that which thinks and likes and doesn't like and wants and doesn't want and feels happy or feels angry or whatever, and that which is aware of that, you know, that kind of self-inquiry is helpful. So that more and more you trust more in just your awareness rather than defining yourself in terms of perceptions and conditions. And where even clinging to the idea you shouldn't have any self is another, you know, attachment to an idea. And this is what I was saying about vipassana, where you say everything is dukkha, one tends to project dukkha onto everything. If I start attaching to the view that the Buddha said everything is dukkha or suffering, then by that attachment, then I tend to project this, that everything is basically suffering, and so I'd be projecting dukkha onto life rather than witnessing, observing it as it really is. And this is the subtlety of it. People sometimes don't see the difference where they grasp the ideas of Buddhism, but they don't realize they're grasping the ideas of Buddhism. They're not practicing the Dhamma because there's this grasping of the ideas. I found that very helpful, like that which is aware. Like I emotionally, somebody says, last week somebody was saying there was some criticisms being made about me. Yeah. And I could, somebody was telling me about these criticisms. And then I could feel this emotion of, you know, being annoyed with these criticisms and feeling defensive in a way, these criticisms. But that which was aware of that process, that which is aware, that's your refuge, not your defense or whatever. So as soon as I trust in this refuge, then I can take the criticisms. But but if I go back to being a person, then I would tend to get defensive from, it's tending to want, thinking that I'm, that they've got it wrong and that they don't understand me and going on in that way. where when I inquire into it, I think that which is aware of this feeling of annoyance or being offended isn't offended. It's a pure awareness, pure intelligence. That's my right. So I keep reminding myself of that and trust in that, so that what happens in my life then is more and more I abide in that than in the emotional reactions I might be having to a situation. Any more questions? Donating the body? Yeah, that's very compassionate. Yes. Well, once you're dead, you don't have to worry about it. That's the nice thing about being dead, is yeah, that's very generous. No, but you're alive right now. And so, I mean, some people, you know, concerned about letting the body be of use when you're no longer alive. That's a very generous thing to do. Yes, I agree. The real rip-off, the funeral. Remember when we first came here, one of my bright ideas in those days was to have a crematorium here. And then the villagers found that they thought, then I got this, they were absolutely horrified that we were thinking of having a crematorium here. So I dropped it. Christmas and Easter, don't die. One of the friends Buddhist friend that died, Muriel Pugh. We had her memorial ceremony yesterday here at Amaravati, and she died on Ascension Day. So she had kind of a gift for kind of dramatic timing. And then yesterday we were planting a tree. Her son and family and friends came and planting this tree in her memory and scattering her ashes out in the field. And during the planting of the tree, it started to rain. And kind of this beautiful rain coming down on this tree. And then it stopped. And then we went out on the field. And then as soon as I finished scattering all the ashes, then the sun came out. This kind of bright flash of sunlight out in the field. So I think Muriel must have been kind of up there arranging it all. It's just to reiterate the pattern, the paradigm of the subject object, and to see that, like in talking about transcendence, and then because this is the experience of subject object being a human being. I mean, with the subject and the object is the human experience. And then in the refuge in Buddha Dhamma Sangha, we have the Buddha is the awakened mind, the pure intelligence, knowing the way things are, the Dhamma. So in this term, Dhamma is what arises, ceases, and realizing the cessation, realizing the presence and the absence is Dhamma. So you're seeing the conditioned Dhamma as just that, and then the unconditioned, the absence of conditions, absence of attachment, absence of self, absence of desire. And that which is aware, you see, is sustained and continuous. It's a steadiness, it's a stillness, a watching, an attention. In that, so that what we call mindfulness, sati, sampachanya, awareness, wisdom, panya. So that that's why we can say in terms of the witness or the observer. But it's not to think of yourself as a witness or observer. Those are just words to help you to remember, to pay attention and notice, pay attention to life. So when things happen in anger or greed or confusion, doubt, uncertainty arise in the mind, that which is aware of doubt or confusion isn't confused or doubtful, it's aware. Or in a dark room, that which is aware of the dark isn't dark, is it? So it's like contemplating, bringing into, so that you're beginning to really trust and develop a sense of refuge and trust in this paying attention, in awakenedness. Because in heedlessness, we get caught up in the old habits and we operate according to our habits. So if I operate according to my habits as a person, then I'm just a kind of helpless victim of circumstances. Everything goes well, I'm happy. Everything falls apart, I'm miserable. People praise me, they say, you're wonderful, I'm happy. People say, you're terrible, and I feel depressed. The monks and the nuns, they want to be monks and nuns for life. They love the life, they dedicate their life to the Dhamma, and they want to stay and help here at Amaravati and teach and develop and support and do all the good things. I'm happy. And they all want to leave, disrobe, and have intimate relationships with partners. Then I'm depressed. I'm a helpless victim of circumstance. Everything's going nicely, I'm happy. Everything's going against me, I'm not. So I'm a helpless victim. So how are you going to, you can't make life just on the, you know, life isn't going to be just what you want, is it? It's just not that way. You get some things go well and some things don't. So it changes and it's all subject to so many other things. But this way you're finding that stillness, that steadiness within, in which you can, because you can bear the ups and downs, highs and lows of existence, if you have a refuge in this stillness, in this wisdom. But if you don't have that, then life is pretty, you know, God, it's terrible. It's terrible for me if I... an emotional person, and go up and down like that. But in the stillness, then you learn from whatever is happening, and you really learn a lot from the unpleasantness of life. You know, it's not to be despised. It's something, you know, that. Because we don't want it, and we kind of dread it and fear it, it oftentimes is very good for us. Because maybe we spent too much time trying to avoid unpleasantness, or, you know, we worry and dread and make our lives, even when things are going quite well, we can make our lives quite miserable just through anticipating misery in the future. So watch the mind. I find it really, you know, what is it that watches the mind? Because it's, you can't become a watcher, you just watch. Mm-hmm. Pay attention, you don't, it's not, you just wake up like this, you're just aware. Your mind opens, it's present. It's simple like that, immediate. You think, I'm practicing to become mindful, you've missed it. Isn't that, I'm practicing to become mindful, and then you've got an idea of mindfulness in your head, and you're trying to become somebody who's mindful, and doesn't work. Not the way it is. It's much more simple than that, than practicing in order to become somebody who's mindful. It's just being mindful. Listening, attention. And what goes on in your, you know, what, like in your heart. What do you feel like in here? And then a lot of, like with most people, there's a lot of unresolved emotions, like resentments of and things like that, and that we dismiss, or we don't recognize, and we don't see. But in seeing it in terms of Dhamma, then we feel, we can feel a courage in looking at what we most fear, because we're looking at it in the right way. We're not looking at it in terms of personal conventions anymore, but it's what it really is. So you develop a courage to look at things that before you were maybe very frightened of, resistant to. This is really interesting. What's some of the difficult patches is when there's nothing interesting left. And you have to look at the desire to find something interesting. Yeah? Well, the thing is that, I mean, because you are, you know, if you just come off retreat, then you've got that kind of clarity that comes through a simpler life where you don't have a lot of, and the routine of ordinary life is, you're not caught in it. And you, so just recognize that, one thing, recognize that this is a result of living in a certain way, practicing. And but then most of life can't be like that, you know. So you maybe come and spend 10 days a year doing that, but the rest of your life isn't going to be in that way, having all that kind of supportive encouragement and that. So this is why to reflect on your life the way it is, and. I mean, because one thing is that you, coming off a retreat, sometimes you can make a strong, you know, like, I'm not going to read the newspaper anymore, and I'm not going to watch the television, and I'm going to practice so many hours a day, and then you know very well you can only do that for a while, and then it all stops. The kind of momentum is gone, and back to the old. But keep going, really, you know, recognize where you are now, and then you just keep in little ways all the time, even next month when you're back at work and in the routine of your ordinary life. But just take time to just stop and just learn to stop yourself now and then, rather, and to just ask yourself what you're really feeling, and not as a criticism, but just to break the momentum of habit, because it's in the normal life, ordinary life, that your habits are reinforced, and so you can break up those habits just by. I mean, even though maybe your rational mind thinks that you're not doing it, you actually are, just by breaking the momentum of just being caught into the habit and going around and around and on to the next one. So I like to use the sound of silence a lot for that, for ordinary life, where I just stop and listen to the silence. Collect myself with that. Just even if it's for a second, it's better than not bothering. Because after a while, your mind will find that it is naturally coming to you, and you'll find the momentum of habitual behavior, you know, fading without you kind of resisting it, you know, saying, I'm not going to do this anymore, and then failing at it all the time. But you'll find more natural kind of fading out will happen. So the challenge in daily life is to accept it on it, for what it is, and to know yourself, to admit yourself, not to criticize yourself, but to be able to use it for mindfulness, and to say when you see yourself very attached to something or caught in, you know, in the momentum of old habits or bad habits, and just to stop, just to go to the silence or go to the breath or something, just to break the momentum, just for a second, or even the idea of it will help. Even if you don't do it, just the thought of it is better than not even thinking about it. You see what I mean? You'll integrate the practice very well if you do it this way. It's not as dramatic as suddenly, you know, never reading a newspaper again. But sometimes, I mean, that can be another ego thing too, you know. I'm not going to do this, and I'm not going to do that. But, I mean, we can really hate ourselves for having these habits, and that's another habit, you know, of criticizing yourself or thinking that you shouldn't be doing what you're doing or whatever, or that you can't practice it anymore, things like this. But just that which is aware of that as an object, trust in that in just little ways, like where you work and so forth, just to use that situation to compose yourself. Or just to remember that, even you will find it, you know, the accumulative effect over a period of time is quite significant. Or if you're just trying to do it as an act of will, you can only sustain that for a little while, and then it falls apart. So, I'll let you go.